This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, a discussion about dissent. University of Chicago law professor Cass Sunstein is our guest. His latest book, Why Societies Need Dissent, examines our tendency to conform, examines the risks posed by conformity, and the value of dissent. Sunstein says dissent is not always helpful, but in areas where we're not certain we have the right answer, it can help us sort it out. He says when dissent is stifled, we're left without the insights, the knowledge, the beliefs of the dissenter. We have a liability on our hands because we lack information that could be critical. He says we may face serious trouble, even catastrophe. Listeners, I invite your thoughts, your questions, your comments on dissent for our guest, Cass Sunstein. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Cass Sunstein is the Carl N. Llewellyn Distinguished Service Professor of Jurisprudence at the University of Chicago. He's the author of numerous books, including Republic.com and One Case at a Time. His new book, Why Societies Need Dissent, is published by Harvard University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Sunstein, thanks so much for joining us today. Welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Conformity, of course, is a very powerful draw, and you know it. It's often very sensible. Would you talk with us about conformity and what is its pull?
Yeah, I think there are two reasons why people conform. One is if a lot of people are doing or saying something, there's reason to believe that they're right. So if everyone in the community thinks that the Iraq War is a good idea or that Howard Dean is an excellent candidate or that arsenic is very dangerous in drinking water, then you might think, well, they can't all or mostly be wrong, and so I'll go along with them. And the problem with that is each of them might be participating in the same form of reasoning. So the fact that you have dozens or hundreds or even thousands of people thinking something is no guarantee that it's right. But there's a lot of pressure to go along just because of the sheer force of numbers. The second reason doesn't have to do with just the likelihood that a lot of people are right, but instead the social pressures that are imposed by those who depart from orthodoxy. So you might think that if lots of people think the Iraq war was a good idea, and you just don't, you might silence yourselves or even go along with them just to avoid being ostracized or ridiculed. And this happens, you know, in its left-wing form sometimes on college campuses, and its right-wing form it happens sometimes on talk radio.
Mm. Around the world, do people conform to the same degree, that is, across cultures?
It is amazing the fact that people are usually conformists, and we don't show or find very large differences across cultures. So there are these really fun experiments about conformity that ask people to say whether one line, which is a certain length, say 3 inches, is matched to one or another or still another of 3 lines that are on a separate piece of paper. And those are, you know, one clearly matches and two are clearly off. And the experiments have a bunch of people in the room who are plants who make the wrong match. And the question is whether subjects, meaning ordinary people, will conform to the mistake or go along with the evidence of their own senses. And there are very high rates of conformity, not just in America, but in the dozens of countries in which these tests have been conducted. Countries that are supposed to have conformist cultures, like Japan, do show slightly higher rates of conformity than cultures that are supposed to show a lot of individualism, like the United States. But it's not a huge difference. Conformity seems to be built into human nature.
Yeah. At the outset of your book, you share some examples of conformity that has led to problematic situations and disastrous situations. You mentioned corporate boards, the White House, the judiciary. Maybe you'd take one or two of those examples and talk about them with us.
Yeah. President Kennedy, you know, is a revered president, but he had at least one disaster, which was at the Bay of Pigs. This was an attempted invasion of Cuba, which turned out to be a ludicrous failure, in which Cuban exiles tried to tried military action, and the U.S. supported them. And Kennedy said to himself, how could I have been so stupid as to let this go ahead? The people who were there at the time said that it wasn't that anyone was stupid. It's just that within the White House, there was a culture in the early Kennedy presidency of going along with the way the president and others were leaning. So lots of people within the White House had reservations and doubts and knew what might be expected, but they shut themselves up, and the result was an international embarrassment and a lot of unnecessary loss of life. There may be parallels to what's happening in Iraq now. A more recent example is corporate failures and corruption, the Enron example being the most salient, where Congress has fussed a bit about changing the law, trying to have stronger controls on corporate misconduct. But the people who've investigated this most carefully say that the recipe for counteracting corruption and making good business decisions is a corporate board that's full of dissenters and that doesn't have conformists. So the tough questions are asked, there's a lot of contentiousness, and errors are prevented, and big financial losses are foreseen, and the companies don't go that route. Just one other example has to do with investment clubs in the United States. The investment clubs that do worst are those where people are friends, meet in each other's homes, have dinner together, laugh a lot, exchange presents, go to one another's houses for holidays. Those companies, those investment clubs, are very friendly and warm, and they lose a lot of money. The ones that do well are investment clubs where people don't socialize together, don't especially like each other, meet in offices rather than homes, no meals, and they tend to make a lot of money. And the key difference between these two different clubs is that the really friendly ones suppress dissent just because of internal dynamics, and the more business-oriented ones welcome and encourage dissent. And that way they end up being much more profitable.
Yeah. Well, it's like the classroom, that in the tougher the teacher sometimes, the more you're going to be engaged. And, you know, the person who wants to be your friend in front of the classroom is not exactly really your friend.
Right, right. And there's a lesson here for anyone who's part of an organization, which is that, you know, you think that you'll be a team player and go along with how people are talking and the course of action they're taking, but the team player actually is being more selfish than the person who's willing to play devil's advocate, because the person who's willing to play devil's advocate is sacrificing themselves usually a little bit, but getting the group or the organization to make better decisions.
Yeah, there's risk in dissent.
Right.
Going back to the examples that you talked about, the boardroom and the White House. In the boardroom, you said it is important to have dissenters, plural, in the boardroom. And, you know, thinking back to that Bay of Pigs example, I can't remember the source for this, but he or she said if only one person had stood up and dissented, the Bay of Pigs would have been averted. Now, I wonder about that. Do you think that one voice would have resulted in a different outcome in that case?
It might have. Sometimes a single dissenter can make a really big difference. We have two kind of tales in the culture of this. One is the story of the emperor's new clothes,
mm-hmm.
where a little boy says the emperor is naked, and then the whole crowd starts seeing it. And the other is 12 Angry Men, the Henry Fonda movie, where there was a single holdout mm-hmm. who moved the jury in the right direction. And those aren't just fictional stories. In lots of organizations all over the country, and I bet listeners can think of their own favorite examples, if one person is willing to speak out, things will change. And I have some evidence of this, where on, among judicial panels, if you get one Republican sitting with two Democrats, or one Democrat sitting with two Republicans, the single dissenter can really make a huge difference. But you are right that if there's a culture that is very set on a particular course of action, then the dissenter might just be ignored or marginalized.
Yeah. We do speak of a voice in the wilderness, and I'm thinking now of the Beatles song, The Fool on the Hill, who, of course, is seeing everything
right
perfectly,
right,
clearly.
I know the song, I'm proud to say.
But, you know, going back to this idea of one voice or a minority voice, you know, minorities can move the majority as well. What can you tell us about how minorities have been able to turn us to see something in a new light?
Yeah, they have big effects, minorities, and sometimes it doesn't happen immediately, but in a few days it does happen. So in the U.S., the movement for gay rights has been very much a minority movement, but the arguments have been pressed frequently enough and forcefully enough that the nation has turned around amazingly in just a few short years. So much so that a conservative, very conservative Supreme Court ruled that Texas couldn't make sodomy a crime. So minorities often have a big impact that isn't initially acknowledged by majorities, and especially if they don't advertise themselves sometimes as, you know, as different from everybody else, but act as if they're part of the national conversation. And many of the largest changes in the U.S., both movements to the left and movements to the right, have been driven by majorities that have become minorities or gotten majority support.
Could we, should we, make some effort to reward dissent? And how would you go about doing that, if you could?
Yeah, well, the first thing I do is to stop punishing dissent. And the punishments for dissent in a country that's free like ours, they are informal rather than formal. People don't go to jail very much for dissenting, but they may be disliked, lose promotions, pick up subtle social signals that say, shut up, or you're going to be at risk. So I think the first thing we should do is to have a much broader recognition that dissenters are really helping their organizations, typically, rather than harming. Yet they're acting as good citizens. In some of his less fortunate remarks, Attorney General Ashcroft at least could be taken to be suggesting that critics of the administration's policies are acting in a way that helps their adversaries. Mm-hmm. Then this, I hope the Attorney General didn't mean that, and this is not a helpful sentiment. President Roosevelt, the first Theodore Roosevelt, emphasized that dissent was a civic duty and that a president ought to welcome severe disagreement with his policies, because that'll help keep him on the right track. So the first thing is just not to punish it. In terms of rewarding it, there are lots of things organizations can do. They can create separate institutions that have missions of coming up with new ideas, creating a system of checks and balances, so that your special obligation is to show how what's happening now is not right, how we can do it better. You could have a system of ombudsmen, you know, like the New York Times recently hired an ombudsman who's paid money and in that sense is rewarded, and his job really is to show how the organization isn't working so well. So you can provide financial and social rewards to people who come up with good ideas which are critical of the status quo. But I think the most important thing, and this really is a threat even in a country as free as ours, is to eliminate the often subtle punishments that are imposed on dissenters.
Yeah. There is, on the jacket of your book, there's a photograph of a man in a city dressed... well, he's sticking out He's sticking out. he's wearing black and bright green striped pants, and he's got a megaphone, but no one is really paying any attention to him. And one wonders what he's talking about. I mean, that's the point, really. Here, the question I want to raise here is, you know, when do we say a dissenter has got something that we need to listen to, and when do we say, well, he's a crackpot?
Right. Well, I don't think there's any abstract answer to that. It depends on what he's saying. So probably if there's a dissenter, at least it's worth 2 seconds of your time to check it out. We all have filters so that can filter out the crackpots, and some of the filters are pretty sensible ones. So if it's about, you know, the extraterrestrials among us who are controlling, you take your pick which organization, we can filter that out. But otherwise, we should listen to the argument. I guess one filter I personally think is a pretty good one is if we're tempted not to listen to it because it's a political perspective other than ours,
mm-hmm.
that's a warning sign that we should actually be listening. Mm-hmm. We'll probably hear enough of what we ourselves mm-hmm. think.
So if my blood pressure grows up, I should really make an effort to
I should probably listen. Yeah.
Cass Sunstein is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him today about dissent. His latest book is Why Societies Need Dissent. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Something that I would like very much to talk with you about this afternoon, cascades. You write about this extensively in your book, Why Societies Need Dissent. Very interesting. Would you give us some examples of cascades? What is a cascade?
Okay, a cascade is when information travels from one person to another, and then from the second person to the third. And then three people think something, and the fourth person goes along, not because the fourth person has information that the first three are right, but because the mere fact that three people think it is pretty good reason to believe that it's true. And then you have four people who think it, and a fifth person is pretty likely to go along unless the fifth person is really confident or an expert. And now that five people think it, the sixth person in line had better go along, too, unless they are really confident. And pretty soon you can get dozens or hundreds of people thinking something. The example I just gave is pretty artificial. But if you look at practices by doctors, doctors will themselves tell you that they're often participants in a cascade where what they do in terms of their medical technique is much influenced by what they think other doctors do. But, of course, the other doctors are doing it because of what they think other doctors are doing. So you have a bunch of people participating in a practice which may not be a good one, but it perpetuates itself just because everyone thinks that everyone else is doing it. And you can maybe think of fads with respect to food or clothing or exercise that are just cascades. And sometimes the fact that lots of people are going a certain direction is no problem at all. The direction isn't bad. The patients are getting better. The diet actually works. But sometimes it isn't. And that if people disclose what they actually knew, which is they're actually getting fatter, not thinner, or they're not getting healthier because of, let's say, a certain form of psychiatric treatment, but they think other people are doing it, and so they may as well continue. These continue just because of people's perception of what other people are doing. There was one pretty funny one I noticed because it's close to my law world, which is that President Bush had this military tribunal executive order, which a lot of people don't like very much. I don't love it myself very much. But you got hundreds of law professors signing a letter saying that this was an unconstitutional order, Now, it isn't a great order, but it's not unconstitutional under existing law. How could hundreds of law professors sign something saying it was unconstitutional? The reason is they were in a cascade. Once five or six people signed on, then the seventh and eighth thought, well, they must be right. And then by that time, you can start accumulating plenty of signatures. So whenever a lot of people end up signing something, there's a risk that they aren't reflecting their independent judgments. They're just deferring to the accumulated knowledge, which appears to be shown by the fact that there are other people involved. But the funny and really sad thing is that each of those people might well themselves be signing or acting just because other people are.
Yeah. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Let's go first to a caller in Eureka, line four. Hi.
Hi. A comment and a question. When you were talking about a cascade, I thought of the social psychologist Robert Cialdini, who wrote a fascinating book entitled Influence, How and Why People Agree to Do Things, later retitled The Psychology of Persuasion, that he says essentially that in times of stress or times of uncertainty or anxiety, or when people just don't know what to do, they look to other people to take their cues from, again, calling it social proof. My question would be, I wonder if your guest could comment on the idea of groupthink, which I am acquainted through some of the literature about the decisions made about the Vietnam War, and I realize my knowledge is quite superficial, but does the guest think that there is something to it, and could he maybe give his ideas about the concept?
I think your information sounds anything but superficial. It sounds like you know a ton about this. I appreciate the Cialdini reference. What Cialdini talks about is, you know, you may not know about whether aspirin actually helps or whether organic foods are good for you, but if lots of people are using aspirin or eating organic foods, you'll follow social proof, which is the practices of other people. That's what Cialdini talks about, and Cialdini actually was a real influence on my book because he suggests that one way people are gotten to believe and to do things is just by perceiving that other people believe or do those things. And what Cialdini didn't connect this to, because he wasn't a lawyer or a person interested in politics much, was how our legal and political systems sometimes go wrong. So I like the Cialdini reference.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting analogy about the law professors.
Great, thanks. And the groupthink idea also is an influence on this project. And the guy who did that, Irving Janis, did something great. And I think he's quite right in identifying a process by which people who kind of have the same inclination end up not testing their own beliefs. They end up fortifying their own beliefs, and they can often end up, through this process of groupthink, doing something that's bad. And if you think something the Clinton administration did really went sour, and if you think something the Bush administration did was a big mistake, you could easily tell a groupthink story. I think the groupthink literature is very good, but I'll tell you a problem I have with it, which is that it's too complicated. If you try to figure out what the conditions of groupthink are and preconditions are and what the mechanisms are and what the cures are, you end up getting very long lists, kind of like an infuriating undergraduate professor who gives you these long lists, and so you can't figure out what you're supposed to know or what you've learned. I would try to understand these groupthink examples in a much simpler way, which is that if you have a group of people who are inclined in a certain direction, I'm just going to say one sentence, if you have a group of people who are inclined in a certain direction and they talk to each other, they're going to end up in a more extreme version with a more extreme version of the position they originally held. So if you have a group of people who think that global warming is a serious problem, after they've talked to one another, they're likely to think that it was a very serious problem. If you've got a group of French people who don't trust the United States, mm-hmm. after they talk to one another, they're going to show extreme distrust of the United States. If you've got a group of people who think that the Iraq War was a good idea, after they talk to one another, they're going to think it was a very, very good idea. So that simple idea, which is that groups end up at a more extreme point in line with their tendencies before they started to talk. That's been documented now in over a dozen countries. It's a much simpler claim than the groupthink claim, and I think it explains all of the groupthink examples.
Like in the Vietnam War, when one did not, or if one would have spoken up, I guess you were talking to earlier, strongly, that probably would have had little or no effect because the others were convinced and they did not.
Yeah, that's the group. This I'm not an example. I'm not a an expert on the Vietnam War, but I think you've got it just right, which is that the tendency of the people who were in power was to press that war, and as they talked to one another, they'd go in a more extreme point in line with that tendency, even if there were a few dissenters. Mm-hmm. So I've done some studies of juries, and about juries and how outraged jurors are about a company's misconduct. And jurors' outrage is heightened by talking to each other. So even if there are a few people who aren't outraged, if the middle member is outraged, then the group as a whole ends up more outraged than the middle member. So even if you've got a couple outliers, a couple dissenters, if the group has a tendency in one or another direction, it's likely to end up in a more extreme point in that direction, unless you've got a very articulate dissenter.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, a listener in Bolingbrook, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to offer this on conformity. I have a copy of the Chicago Tribune from Sunday, August 29th, 1999. It's a quote from Ben Sahn, S-A-H-N. He says, "What is it about us, the public, and what is it about conformity itself that causes us all to require it of our neighbors and of our artists, and then, with consummate fickleness, to forget those who fall into line and eternally celebrate those who do not?" So I thought that might be a little ironic side note as an offering.
That's a great quote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a terrific quote.
Thanks. Thanks for the call this afternoon. It reminds me, Professor Sunstein, of the value of the dissenting judicial opinion and where that can take us.
Yeah. In our free speech tradition is really pretty new, and it owes its current shape to these dissents by Justice Holmes and Justice Brandeis, who kept saying government shouldn't be allowed to do that in a free society, and that they eventually prevailed. In at least 130 occasions, at least 130, the Supreme Court overruled itself and has come into line with the view of a dissenter.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Yeah. Yesterday I was reminded of a quote from Mark Twain where he said that we have freedom of speech and freedom of conscience and the prudence not to practice either. And which this conversation kind of reminds me of, because I think there's a really big unspoken truth here, and that is that because we pursue the we think we're in pursuit of happiness in this country. One of the major ideas of happiness is being able to live amongst people who think like you do, you know. And so I'm kind of, and I'm also reminded that on this station a while ago, some NASA people were. So proud of the fact that they had a system, whereas if anyone had any kind of doubts about anything, any launch, that they were going to, that everything would stop until those doubts were resolved, so that we had kind of a consensus system going on. And then the Columbia disaster occurred. I don't really have a question, except I'm just thinking that there are these really strong currents that make it difficult to be at the center, and I guess I'll hang up and listen to you respond. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a terrific example, and I really thank you for it, which is that it is true that NASA sometimes said publicly that if there's any doubt, we wouldn't launch. But after the recent disaster, there was a careful study done of NASA, and it attributed the disaster not to simple mechanical error, but to a sick culture of conformity. And the argument was, whatever NASA said publicly, it did not have an internal system of checks and balances, it did not welcome dissent, that the all the premium was placed on saying it's safe to go. And that's a recipe for disaster. And the recommendation was, you want to create a culture that welcomes dissent, where people aren't punished or silenced for raising doubts. You want internal checks and balances. That's the way to save lives.
Hmm. Cass Sunstein is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. His latest book is Why Societies Need Dissent. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here are some terms, some words that we hear pretty often these days. Coalition building, partnering, consensus. Does the desire for conformity wax and wane? I know that in the wake of September 11th, we all wanted reassurance and we all hung together with waving the flag and whatnot. And it seems to me maybe we're in a time where we want to be reassured, we want to have that consensus and you know, breaking free of the status quo is not so important at the moment.
Right. Well, it is true that sometimes the culture places a bigger premium on conformity than others. And post-September 11th, there's a lot more conformity pressure than there was before. That's true. The only thing I'd say about that is that conformity pressures can be really bad for national security. After World War II was successfully fought, one of Roosevelt's chief advisors said, "We fought this war well because we were a democracy which had openness and dissent, so that when a military operation was going in the wrong direction, either people within the military or outsiders would spot it as quickly as possible or complain about it after it had gone wrong." And so the system was kept constantly on its toes by the fact that leaders didn't just hear what they wanted to hear. And that's why we could fight a lot better than Germany and Japan and Italy. In those countries, the advisor said, it's not like the soldiers were less loyal to their totalitarian countries than our soldiers were. Those soldiers were loyal and they fought bravely and hard. The problem was the dictators didn't get the information they needed to make good military decisions, and that's why World War II turned it out to be pretty easy for us, even though we got in late. So a culture that's threatened from outside does itself no favors by suggesting that we all need to toe a party line.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, I noticed something in the last few months, and I wondered maybe your guest could comment on it. It seems to me like this administration spends a lot of time saying things like everybody knows and nobody believes, using phrases like that that indicates that there is no dissent. And I wondered if that has a psychological subconscious impact on the population at large. And I'll take comments offline. Thank you.
Ooh, that's a very interesting point, and it is true that a good rhetorical strategy, if you want to silence people, is to say everyone knows and no one disagrees, because then you make people, it works on people. It makes them think, well, I have to know what everyone knows, so I have, and if no one thinks that, then I can't be someone who thinks that, because then I'd be by myself or a nutcase. So what the administration is doing, to the extent they're doing this, is using this idea the earlier caller referred to of social proof. So if everyone is getting Adidas sneakers, and if no one thinks that, you know, that there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, then chances are that the conventional wisdom is correct. Now, my guess is that in the case where the administration is using this, actually there's a division of opinion. And by saying no one thinks this or everyone knows that, they are quelling dissent.
Mm. Even within their own ranks, too.
Yeah, even within their own ranks. I'm not close. I live in Chicago, so I'm not close to the what's happening in the White House, and I think the president is, you know, under extremely difficult circumstances, doing the best he can, which is not to say that he's doing everything right, but I think he's acting in, you know, a very hard circumstance. But he is not cultivating a culture of dissent internally, and his own reading by reading and listening by his own lights is very sharply constricted to his own advisors. And this is not good for his own presidency. Roosevelt, for example, the second one, cultivated a very unruly administration in which he got lots of different people talking to him. And he'd give several of them clues that he agreed, even though he couldn't agree with all of them because they disagreed with each other. And he did this to try to get as much information as he possibly could.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one. Hello.
Hi. My hubby ends up chairing a lot of committee meetings, and one of the things he tells people is to encourage your discussion is that if everybody agreed, most of the people in the committee would be redundant. Wouldn't be any reason to have them there. Are you there?
Yeah, that's okay. Great. Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't tell.
Yeah, I was just listening. That's great. It's like actually a debate in the early days of the United States, when the First Amendment, which protects freedom of speech, originally there was a proposal to add there's a right to instruct your representative how to vote. So the idea would be the citizens of Massachusetts could tell their representative, you have to vote this way, and that would be a constitutional right. And that proposal was defeated on the ground that it would destroy the point of the meeting. The whole point of the meeting is to have people who are different talking to one another and expressing different views, and that's what your husband's trying to get.
I'm just sitting here looking at a quote from Hermann Göring, and I'm going to try to condense it, but it's he says that most people don't want to go to war. He said, but it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. And I feel like that's what has been going on in this country lately. Gary.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I mean, even if, with respect to Iraq, President Bush has made correct decisions, still, the existence of disagreement should be welcomed, because this is how you constrain the government from making mistakes.
Well, all we had to do was get some troops over there, and suddenly it was support our troops, don't disagree, support the troops. If you raise any concerns about what we're up to, that we might be sticking our fist into a hornet's nest, for instance, by going it alone, you're not supporting the troops.
Right, and that is, to talk in those terms is actually un-American, because it demonizes people who are in good faith, concerned about what's happening over there, and treats them as unpatriotic, when in fact they are doing the best they can to make their country work better.
Let's talk with another caller, listener in Chicago, line four. Hi.
Hello. I was interested in your comparison in the styles of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and George W. Bush, and I think that if you look at the two of them, despite their similar moneyed backgrounds, George W. Bush is the most unsophisticated person that I've ever seen. He seems to have had a very narrow life experience, and whenever I've seen him in situations where he is unfamiliar, he is very suspicious and distrustful acting. And I think a person like that with a limited life experience, a limited intelligence, cannot work with dissent because they cannot make judgments given two opposing opinions. And therefore, in order for him to be a forceful president, I think his assistants have to present him with one point of view, one argument, and assume and give him the impression that everyone agrees with it.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, the Bush-Roosevelt comparison is intriguing because both of them are known for their serenity. Bush doesn't worry much, and Roosevelt didn't worry much either. But one difference is that Bush's serenity seems kind of tight and tense sometimes, or fending off tightness and tension, whereas Roosevelt's serenity was easier and more open. So I do think Bush is actually an extremely intelligent person. So the one thing
I've never seen any evidence. I think he might be clever. I think he might be cunning. Yeah. But I do not think that he is intelligent. I'm sorry.
Well, I can't prove it.
No, you really will not be able to. There's no empirical evidence.
I'll tell you what I think about Bush on this count in particular. Not only do I think he's working in good faith, but I also think he's combines a high degree of intelligence with a low degree of articulateness. So he's not good with words, and he knows it, but his thinking isn't so bad. He did, I mean, not that this is proves much, but he did do pretty well on his SATs. So in terms of sheer tests of ability, he's pretty good. The only thing I'd want to say about Bush is that to the extent that his administration has been very critical of dissent as such, and it has, they are not doing the country or themselves any favors.
I want to thank the listener for her call. We have to wrap up here. Maybe by way of wrapping up, I'd like to ask you to expand on something that you write about in the book, and that is we haven't talked a great deal about the First Amendment per se, although we have been talking very much about free speech. You say in the book it is important not only to have that First Amendment, but to nurture a culture of free speech. Maybe this afternoon, to wrap up here, you would talk with us about what are the features of a culture of free speech?
Yeah, we have a legal system that protects free speech, but our culture is a lot more mixed on this. The first thing the culture does is it doesn't reprimand or punish or attack people who are dissenting from the prevailing wisdom, and this includes conservatives on college campuses who are sometimes demonized, and it includes liberal critics of the war. So the culture sees people who are departing from the prevailing wisdom as patriotic, too. But it goes a little deeper than that, that a culture that's dedicated to free speech has a commitment to respectful listening. So it's not just that speakers get to say what they want and they won't be hurt. It's also that they'll be treated as fellow citizens who might be right. During World War II, the famous judge with a very funny name, Learned Hand, tried to define what the spirit of liberty is. He said the spirit of liberty is that spirit which is not too sure that it is right. Mm-hmm. And a culture of free speech consists of citizens who aren't too sure that they're right. Mm-hmm.
Professor Sunstein, thank you very much for being my guest this afternoon.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Professor Cass Sunstein, his latest book is Why Societies Need Dissent. The book is published by Harvard University Press. Cass Sunstein is the Carl N. Llewellyn Distinguished Service Professor of Jurisprudence at the University of Chicago.